This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
You don't just live in your home. You live in your neighborhood as well. So when you're shopping for a home, you want to know as much about the area around it as possible. Luckily, Homes.com has got you covered. Each listing features a comprehensive neighborhood guide from local experts. Everything you'd ever want to know about a neighborhood, including the number of homes for sale, transportation, local amenities, cultural attractions, unique qualities, and even things like median lot size and a noise score. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
Hey, sports fans, it's Mason Crosby.
And Reese Crosby.
If you enjoy football, football,
be sure to check out Kicking It with the Crosbys. New episodes drop every Tuesday and Thursday.
Subscribe on the free Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Coming up next half hour, we've got Ag Commissioner Mike Strain joining us. You know, Mardi Gras is the time a lot of people have their first crawfish of the season. Some people are, you know, crazy rich and have it for Christmas and pay like $8 a pound for it. But the prices are coming down. You can get it for under $4 a pound now. And so I was curious, have you had crawfish and how were they? And what's got to be in your boiling pot? I am horribly disappointed if I go to a crawfish boil and there's not sausage and mushrooms available. That's just absolutely necessary for me. One person texts us on the Oakwinard Jewelers talk and text line and says, Dave, garlic has got to be in the boiling pot. Is that for the flavor, or do you actually eat the garlic cloves after they come out of the boil? Somebody else says, crawfish seasoning has to have citrus in it, orange and lime. Again, do you eat the oranges that are in the pot, or is it just there to kind of smooth the spicy that goes along with the crab boil, the cayenne, and everything else in there? Somebody else says, good morning. I've had crawfish four times already, three times in Ponchatoula for $3.50 and $4 per pound, and once in Mandeville for $4 per pound. They were mostly good size, not very small, but not too big, and delicious. So, yeah, I have not had any crawfish yet this season. I am long overdue. There's a few people in my life who I promised a crawfish boil a couple of years ago. And then, you know, we had the pandemic. Then we had that horrible crawfish season where there were no crawfish, although we're all tiny and very expensive. So I really, really have to make good on promises to a few people who I have pledged to boil seafood for them for a few years now. So I am planning. I don't know when. Usually we don't boil our crawfish till May or June. Often we do a Mother's Day crawfish boil. Rarely do we do a Mardi Gras crawfish boil. But if you do and you have, let me know how the crawfish are looking. We have some fog out there, getting texts from north of I-12, particularly between LaRonger and Ponchatoula, about some dense fog, and then some dense fog down along the Refinery Row in the river parishes and over toward Baton Rouge. Let's see if it's impacting traffic now here on WWL. Congrats to the LSU Tiger baseball team shining in a big league park last night and dismantling a top 20 opponent in Dallas Baptist. Looks like these Tigers are for real. We'll get details coming up in about 10 minutes in WWL Sports. Texts are coming in on the Oakwinard Jewelers talking text line about boiling crawfish and the garlic in the crawfish pot. I'll read some of those for you coming up after we check on your forecast and see when we've got rain in the forecast.
Now, your Garcia Roofing forecast on WWL.
Making our way through this week, the weather looks okay for the next few days. It is going to be cloudy today with a high of 73, but outside of that, no big rain in the forecast. 69 and sunny on Friday, 73 and sunny on Saturday, and 67 and sunny on Sunday. It's going to be a gorgeous weekend for parades. Hate to play with your emotions, but I do think we're going to have to introduce a higher chance of rain on Lundy Gras on Monday. I've bumped up the chances to 40 to 50%, so maybe some scattered rain Monday afternoon. Tuesday for Mardi Gras, that still does not look like a washout. I've got a 20% chance of rain on Mardi Gras with a high in the upper 70s, but maybe some storms rolling in by early Wednesday for Ash Wednesday. Of course, follow the forecast closely as things could still change. From WWL Louisiana, I'm meteorologist Pete Malone.
All right, so a few showers possible just here or there on Thursday. Looking more likely on Lundi Gras on Monday. We'll have to wait and see the timing on that, if it interferes with the Orpheus Parade and all of the celebrations along the riverfront in New Orleans and in Kenner. And then maybe Tuesday night, some more rain, but you know how the weather is here. It's so hard to accurately time out any arriving rain more than a couple of days in advance. So we will keep an eye on it for you. We're keeping an eye on the fog right now. Visibilities are low in Hammond and Houma, down to a quarter or half a mile. A few spots folks are texting us where visibility is a tenth of a mile or less, but widespread, no real problems. They're not convoying on the causeway. It's not coned off. Visibility over the lake looks fine. You've got 4 miles visibility now with some shallow fog reported at the airport in Kenner, so not messing with travel there. Slidell's 9 miles of visibility, so you can see fine there as well. If you've come across some fog that's causing a problem once you've safely navigated it and arrived where you're going, would you please text us on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and Text Line when you can safely do so, and let us know where that fog was so we can let other people know. Coming up next half hour, talking to the Ag Commissioner, Mike Strain. Going to find out what's going on with crawfish. We've had these several spurts of cold weather. Has it been warm enough long enough now to get the crawfish out of the mud, into the traps, and into our bellies for a reasonable price? We'll find out what's going on with crawfish prices, egg prices, and chicken prices, too, because that's been in the spotlight. Folks were texting earlier about what has to be in the crawfish pot. Otherwise, you're disappointed at the crawfish boil. And garlic is high on many people's lists. One person texts us on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and Text Line at 504-260-1870. He says, I will fight you for the garlic. No need. You can have it. Another person says, I don't eat the extras. Takes up too much room in my belly, although I do love me some garlic and onions to eat. Really? So you skip the potatoes, the corn, the sausage, the mushrooms, the hot dogs, whatever else are thrown in there, because you want almost exclusively crawfish. Other than garlic and onions. Another person says, I enjoy the garlicky flavor and always eat a few pieces too, but too much keeps the family away for the day. And somebody else says, yes, eating the garlic out of the crawfish boil whole is good, or you can mush it up in your potato. Keep the text coming. What has to be in that crawfish pot for you to enjoy the crawfish boil? And have you had crawfish yet this season? Let me know at 504-260-1870. Coming up, we're going to get the news, sports, weather, and traffic for you. And then we'll open up the What Is Wrong With People file again for you. As I'm Dave Cohen, filling in for Tommy Tucker. Next half hour, Mike Strain, the commissioner of the Louisiana Department of Agriculture, joins us to get us updated on everything going on with crawfish, eggs, chicken, and more. If you have any questions for him, let me know. Folks are fondly remembering Gene Hackman, and as we await word on what killed him, his wife, and his dog in their home, foul play not suspected. One person texts us, says, by far his best role was the preacher in Poseidon Adventure. Somebody else says, Birdcage, loved him in Enemy of the State. Crimson Tide, welcome to Mooseport is my favorite. Somebody else texts us, Popeye Doyle in The French Connection. Lex Luthor, in all caps, with 1, 2, 3, 4 exclamation points. And Behind Enemy Lines was one hell of a movie, RIP, sir. Text coming in this morning. We'll continue that conversation coming up. But right now we welcome in the commissioner of the Louisiana Department of Agriculture and Forestry, Mike Strain, on this Friday Eve. Hey, Mike, how you doing?
Man, I am doing great. It's good to be home. I've spent the week in Washington, D.C., a lot of it up on Capitol Hill. So, but I got to come home last night, so all that is good, and be home here as we go into Mardi Gras weekend. A lot of things going on. Yesterday, I was with U.S. Secretary Brooke Rollins, and you know, we had a very good discussion about what's going on with eggs and poultry, and you know, the Trump administration had its first official cabinet meeting yesterday around 10 o'clock, and Secretary Rollins says, I said, I want you all to think about this probably for one of the first times in modern history. the big ticket item on the table as far as agriculture is concerned is poultry. We're going to be talking about chickens at the cabinet meeting. And yesterday, Secretary Rollins informed us before the cabinet meeting of the plan to deal with the avian influenza and the egg shortage.
Did you leave confident that the federal resources will be there despite all the cutting going on in the federal government to address this avian flu issue and the prices of eggs and poultry?
Yes, I did. They're looking at it. It's $1 billion, a multi-pronged approach. Immediately instituting $500 million towards greater biosecurity measures. $400 million is going to be made available for the affected farmers. We've lost right at now over 11% of our egg production, and that's not counting the broiler production, but also $100 million into immediate vaccine research. We saw where a company was awarded tentative approval from the Food and Drug Administration. We met on Tuesday with the FDA. We met with the Food and Drug Administration for more than an hour and a half and a very open and frank discussion about that and other issues. So they are licensing a vaccine now for cattle. They're spending considerable amount of money in addition to this $100 million on research. And our ask to the federal government, to Secretary Rollins, and to our congressional delegations is that when the vaccines become available, that it would be up to the individual states, the state departments of agriculture through their office of the state veterinarian, whether or not the vaccine would be utilized in that state. And some states will object to the use of the vaccine in poultry because they're afraid of that our foreign partners will not buy our poultry if we use this particular type of vaccine in the poultry. Now, we vaccinated our poultry.
So what is the concern internationally about the vaccine used on these chickens?
The main concern is that it would interfere with them testing to see if their chickens had the avian influenza. So I don't think it's very well founded. I think if we don't stop this, currently we're estimating that the cost of eggs is going to rise another 20 to 25%. It's got to stop it in this track, and it's in multiple species. We vaccinate our chickens for other diseases. We vaccinate our cattle for other diseases. We need to add this. We vaccinate our horses and have for many years against flu. We vaccinate our dogs against the flu. Heck, we vaccinate our humans against the flu. We got to get ahead of this. So I think the resources are going to be there. There are going to be other cuts. Things are kind of wild and woolly up there in D.C., and there's a degree of uncertainty about what programs will be funded, what won't. But this is top priority.
It sounds like the efforts are to prevent further spread, to stop the degradation of the chicken population, and so to keep the prices from going skyrocketing even higher. You said another 20 or 25% is anticipated, but it doesn't sound like there's anything that is being done or necessarily could be done to bring prices down at this point.
Actually, there is, and there will be a temporary allowance for the importation of table eggs, probably from Turkey and some other countries to try to get, some eggs, in the market to try to at least hold it steady, maybe bring it down. But at the end of the day, we have got to rebuild those populations of birds. That's the bottom line. But we are going to be allowing some imports to try to take some pressure off of these prices.
All right. The prices of eggs continuing to go up. Are the prices of poultry similarly going to keep rising?
If they could, and that's the whole thing. We've got a lot more, a lot more broilers than we have table egg farms. And so it's tied together. This particular virus, it gets into the, the broiler houses, et cetera. So our big deal is stop it in its tracks, increase biosecurity, get some vaccine in, stabilize things. And then over time, look at, long-term vaccination plus development through selective breeding of birds that are inherently resistant to this virus and others. And the other thing is that we've got to look at vaccinating at the source where these birds go and overwinter in Canada and try to stop the next group of birds, infected ducks and geese, and the next virus type from coming down. This virus is different than it was in 2022.
It's
a different virus. We got to get ahead of it.
We're talking with Mike Strain, the commissioner of Louisiana Department of Agriculture and Forestry. Always learn something from him. I didn't realize the chickens we eat are different than the chickens that lay eggs that we eat. So it's a different population, and the egg-laying hens more impacted by the avian flu at this point than the broilers that we eat. When we come back, I want to focus on crawfish with Mike Strain here on WWL. Right now, traffic. Dave Cohen in for Tommy Tucker. Ag Commissioner Mike Strain is with us. Mike, how are the crawfish doing after those couple of freezes we had?
They are doing great. I can tell you, that's some good bargains out there. You go to Rouse's. Right there on Barone, $3.19 for a pound for some really nice crawfish.
Boiled or live?
I can tell you no, that's live. Live
okay.
Crawfish.
$3.19 a pound. Course, yeah, I got to get a couple of sacks. I owe people a crawfish.
That's right. Not a couple pounds, right? A couple of sacks.
Yes.
This time. And everyone is really, really excited as we're now going, you know, into Mardi Gras and then, of course, Lent. And that's big time for our crawfish farmers. And, the weather has warmed up. And they've got plenty to eat, and we're going to have a nice, nice crawfish season.
I can't wait. Yeah, we've had a couple of not great crawfish seasons, but you're saying even though we had that snow, even though we had a freeze a couple of weeks, was that a week ago?
Yeah, that just slows them down a little bit. That's all. It wasn't cold enough to kill the crawfish, so that is great. It was the drought that caused us to lose the crawfish, not only in the ponds, we lost 100,000 acres of production, plus in the basin. And so we're going to have plenty nice crawfish. Everyone needs to get there and enjoy it. Matter of fact, on the plane last night, I was trying to remember where my crawfish pot was. You know,
Mardi Gras time. Yeah.
Mardi Gras time. It's time to get with it. And again, that really supports our Louisiana economy. Local crawfish, local shrimp, local crabs. We've got some beautiful crabs. And, of course, don't forget about them oysters. So now is the time for your gumbo, for your jambalaya, or look, just boil them, and don't forget, add some Louisiana sweet potatoes, sweeten that pot, and let's have a wonderful,
you know, it's interesting.
Mardi Gras.
People have been telling us what they have to have in the pot. For you, it's got to be sweet potatoes in the crawfish
Absolutely.
Pot. Absolutely. How are the crawfish size right now?
They're pretty good. They're nice. They're really nice. We're very fortunate, and you can get some really nice crawfish, and that's at the $3.19 to $4 a pound. So you'll be excited. I'm excited.
They're getting bigger, and the prices are coming down. Mike Strain, thank you so much. Welcome back to Louisiana just in time for the big Pre-Fat Tuesday weekend. Glad you're back from D.C. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you.
All right, we had sparse crowds last night at parades. We'll talk to Arthur Hardy. Does he expect that to rebound tonight? Gene Hackman dead at the age of 95. Folks are texting us their favorite films he was in. Hoosiers, Poseidon Adventure, French Connection. Someone else says, I had the opportunity to meet Gene Hackman during Mardi Gras about 30 years ago. He was really down to earth and a nice guy. Yeah, he was here for filming the movie Runaway Jury a few years back. I think that was back in like 2003. So there's that. Other text coming in. Someone says, my favorite Gene Hackman movie was him as a supporting actor, but in Enemy of the State with Will Smith. Someone else says Mississippi Burning. Another vote for Hoosiers and Young Frankenstein. Keep the text coming here on WWL. I'm Dave Cohen in for Tommy Tucker. The founder of the Mardi Gras Guide, Arthur Hardy, joins us now. As Arthur, here we are on the Thursday before Fat Tuesday. How you doing?
Oh, I'm ready. What a nice triple header uptown tonight, huh?
Yeah. I got to ask you, though. I went out to Druids and Ala last night, and there were wide swaths on Magazine Street, on St. Charles, even on either side of Gallier Hall, where there were either no people or just a few people here and there. There were some pockets of big crowds, but there were a lot of places where there weren't a whole lot of people out there.
I'm surprised at that. I really am, with the weather. And all the pent-up demand for Mardi Gras after, you know, it's been a long time, right? This is a late Mardi Gras, so I'm surprised to hear that. Maybe it'll ramp up tonight. I mean, I don't know what more you could need than the parades we've got going on right now, and including last night. And I understand the parades were kind of late in getting to Gallier Hall. Have you heard any?
Yeah, I think the start time was supposed to be 6:15, and right. I didn't see a lot of movement on Jefferson until like 7:15. So maybe that had something to do with it.
Yeah.
And, you know, a lot of people had to work today. A lot of kids go to school today. Yeah. So maybe that was part of the problem.
Well, I know the people in Muses want Friday to be a holiday because that parade is wonderful. And, you know, the theme is secret, but if you bought a morning newspaper, there's the carnival bulletin in it that tells us the theme is Return of Super Muse. And that's a throwback to right after Katrina, their first parade afterwards. The Super Muse comes to town and solves all of our problems. Well, apparently she's come back right now.
Ah, so like the superhero way. Super Muse will ride
there
through the
go.
City tonight.
Well, she is back.
I mean,
and that's the third parade, yeah.
I know that you have, you know, a role to play with your guide and everything else, but, I mean, we know all parades are not created equal, and maybe, I don't know, maybe Druids and Allah just don't have the same kind of, you know, they don't throw bedazzled shoes, and they don't have, how many women are in Muses now?
I think about 1,100, yeah. The bigger budget you have, obviously, the more you can do. But that's what's neat about every season is there's variety. You've got some really good small parades. You've got some super cruising. So, you know, you can find something that you'll enjoy. And tonight's an example of that. You know, you start off with Babylon. They've got a saying that Carnival begins when Babylon rolls. They had the first parade of a triple header, and then Chaos, which uses the old Momus floats and expects some really hard-hitting satire on these floats. And they throw out like a deck of playing cards that is a picture of each float, and on the back it explains it to you if you need any explanation. And then, of course, Muses with the shoe. I mean, you know, again, there's something for everybody, and I just hope they can roll on time because it's no fun to be parading at 1 o'clock in the morning. You know?
No, and typically that's what we see with Muses. We frequently see that they don't get off that route till well after midnight. If there's anything that delays the start or a breakdown or any delay during the parade, yeah, it's often midnight, 1 o'clock before the Muses parade finishes downtown in the warehouse.
Yeah, and I don't know what the answer to that is, but come on out tonight. I mean, this weather can't get much better.
And we have a bonus parade in Metairie tonight as well, huh?
Yep, a doubleheader. And, you know, whenever there are two parades, you can just figure there's going to be more people coming out there. So Symphony's going to roll, and that's a nice little parade, and followed by Atlas, which has been bumped all over the place. They moved off for Super Bowl Sunday last year. And then they plan to return to their traditional first Sunday. Then we had rain, so they'll be parading tonight. And two for the price of one. I've been hearing that crowds have been particularly soft and Metairie for the first weekend, so hopefully it'll pick up tonight.
Yeah, well, if you go to Symphony, you can catch some of those chocolate Symphony bars.
Yeah, isn't that a neat throw? That's something you can eat. I like that.
We're talking with Mardi Gras guide founder Arthur Hardy. What do you like to eat on the parade route? Is it moon pies? Is it chiwis? Is it chocolate bars? Is there something that comes off the float and you're like, yes, I was hungry, I'm glad I caught it?
No, for me, it's hot dog and chili. But speaking of eating...
Well, don't throw those off the floats, please.
Oh, no. The Salvation Army has ramped up their presence at Mardi Gras. They've always been there to help first aid-wise, but now they're here to help the first responders by feeding them. They've got a lot of food and things to hand out, and Ubik pies, and just some refreshments for all the first responders. And last night, I learned also for the media, so I ate two... pulled pork sandwiches off the Salvation Army truck. Am I bad or what?
All right. First responders and media. Maybe I'll be stopping by a Salvation Army's tent along the parade route.
Good food.
Good pulled pork.
You'll enjoy yourself, I promise.
We'll be back after this check on traffic with Arthur Hardy, the founder of the Mardi Gras Guide. One person texts us on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talking Text Line and says, this was Allah's first year on Wednesday. Maybe, Arthur Hardy, that was a factor last night. Somebody else texted and said, we needed a day of rest before Muses, so we took it last night. So maybe that explains a couple of explanations for why there were pretty sparse crowds last night on the Uptown Parade Route.
Yeah, maybe so. But, you know, the reason Allah moved into this spot is so they wouldn't be parading past midnight. So I'm not sure of how it wound up. We'll find out. You know, I'm trying to call. You know, I've got trusted soldiers along all the parades that give me reports. but they're all asleep.
So, yeah, well, someone texted us that one of Ala's floats broke down and that delayed things about 10 minutes. They had to switch out the tractor, but that's not – that's
not. No. We'll find out, but not this early. I'm the only one up.
Yeah, everybody else was at the at the parade still midnight. So, they're still flipping and flopping. Big weekend ahead. I mean, we got tonight with – you already talked about Babylon, Chaos, Muses, Symphony, and Atlas. Tomorrow, Saturday, Sunday. I mean, we got parades uptown. We got parades in Slidell. Yeah. We got parades in Kenner. Yeah. We got parades everywhere on the West Bank.
We do. Slidell tomorrow night, doubleheader because of Dionysius being rained out last weekend. So that's Celine and Dionysius. And then tripleheader uptown, Hermes, Detente, Morpheus. Again, something for everybody, a lot of variety. And if the weather holds up, hopefully the crowds will pick up, huh?
Yeah, well, the weather's supposed to be perfect. I mean, we have a little shower tonight, and then Monday there's some rain coming at some point. We'll wait to hear about that, but the weekend looks picture perfect. In terms of, you talked about Metairie, and there's been some reports about very small crowds out there. We'll see what the doubleheader gets tonight, but they don't have any parades Friday or Saturday in Metairie now.
No, there's a lot of potential there for new crews that want to parade. You know, everybody seems to want to parade in New Orleans. But there are no openings, and when we don't see the likelihood that somebody would have to drop out for somebody new to come in. But in Metairie, there are several nights when you could put a parade, and I think the parish would welcome that. So maybe we'll see something new next year. You always hear about – it's a hard thing to do to start a parade. It really is. And a lot of people want to until they find out how much money's involved and how much work's involved. And all these people are volunteers, Dave. You know, they're not getting paid to do these things. And I'm – often wonder what if all the captains said, I had enough. I don't feel like doing this anymore. Is there somebody standing in the wings who says, hey, I'll take that thankless, payless job?
Yeah, and the vast majority of people in these parades pay to ride, pay for their flows, pay their dues, pay for everything. Yes. They're paying a lot of money for this experience. They're not getting paid. So,
they're not. So it's a wonderful thing we do, and it's one of the hardest questions I get asked when I do features around town or out of town or to conventions. Why do you guys do this? As a business model, it doesn't make a lot of sense. And I guess the answer is we enjoy having fun and spreading joy to others. You know,
if you know people who ride, if you know people who march in parades, who ride on floats, it is their life. It's their identity. It's their community. Yep. That's their friends and family. Yep. It's their coming together, and it's their way of really enjoying life. But it ain't cheap for anybody in a dance crew, a marching unit, or riding on a float. I get why, though, Saturday night in Metairie, typically when they had parades over the years, well, the crowds were very small because everyone was at Endymion,
Yeah,
and Sunday,
it's a hard thing to go against.
So the crew of Isis, though, is still parading, just not in Metairie anymore. They'll be in Kenner on Saturday.
They're in Kenner, and that's a nice little parade. And they, have a whole, initiative about breast cancer awareness. So they throw decorated bras. How's that for a throw?
All right, then Monday we get Orpheus Uptown with Proteus, and then Metairie has two parades on Monday, and then, of course, Fat Tuesday, parading Uptown, Metairie, and in Covington. So a whole lot more parading to come. If someone has not gotten a Mardi Gras guide yet, can they still grab one?
Yeah, they're still out there. We haven't sold them all, and hopefully we will, but we've had a good year with it, and I'm enjoying my association with the Times-Picayune and NOLA.com, and that's been a good move for me. It's expanded outreach a bit, and they've treated me well, and I'm still, running the magazine in terms of the content. I'm just not doing the heavy lifting, the ad sales, distribution, printing. They're doing that now, and it's been a relief after 49 years.
Hey, I'm hoping you got let's get the 50th. I'm looking forward to the 50th next year.
Yeah, I'm under contract. One more year.
All right. Well, you better get to work because it better be bigger and better than ever for your 50th.
I'm planning. You know it will.
Arthur Hardy, founder of the Mardi Gras Guide here on WWL. We'll hear his reports throughout the day here on the radio. I'm Dave Cohen in for Tommy Tucker. When we come back after this, what's going on with the White House correspondents? And should the president get to handpick the journalists that cover him? 7:46, Dave Cohen in for Tommy Tucker. For decades, the White House Correspondents Association, an independent group of journalists, has picked which correspondents from which networks, publications, online sources, and others get the coveted spots of covering the President of the United States and the White House. The Trump administration now wants to eliminate that system and handpick who gets to cover the president. I figured we should get the perspective from someone who has been in the White House correspondent pool, who has covered a president or two of the United States. Norman Robinson joins us on the live line. Hey, Norman.
Hey, Dave, how are you?
I'm great. I haven't seen you in a while. Last time I saw you, I think we were on Informed Sources together, so good to talk to you again. Before you were at WDSU, you were a White House correspondent after a stint at WWL-TV. What do you think, as you hear now, that the President of the United States wants to eliminate the process that's been used for so long for picking White House correspondents and handpick who gets to cover him?
It's an egregious affront to the First Amendment. You know, the press is protected under the First Amendment of the Constitution of the United States of America. I find this to be very tyrannical, and it depresses me to no end. It's very unsettling, and I think it's an attack on democracy. I'm a student of history, and I can remember a professor talking about the Sedition Act of 1798, which Congress passed in order to decriminalize anybody speaking disparagingly of the federal government. The Federalists were in power at that time. Congress passed it, and John Adams, President John Adams signed it. And, you know, that is an infamous act that is considered one of the most egregious breaches of the U.S. Constitution in the United States history. And I'm sort of just really unsettled by this whole attack from the Trump administration and its assault upon on the press.
Well, the president's made no, in any way, shape, or form, secret that he does not like the established media, that he calls them the fake news, and he believes he gets unfair coverage from the journalistic community at large. And so his attempt to address that, and he's already in the past refused to take questions from certain networks, certain reporters, at White House press conferences and other media events. But this goes a whole step further when he is going to change what has been the historical process for picking the White House press corps. How did you get to be a member of the White House press corps?
Well, I was chosen. And when I joined CBS News in 1989, one of my first assignments was to cover the White House under George H.W. Bush, who was president at the time. The old man was president at the time. And I was the third correspondent. I was behind Leslie Stahl and Wyatt Andrews. So I was the low person on the totem pole. So more often than not, I got assigned to the press pool because When you really consider what the press pool does, it traipses around behind the president, and it's actually monitoring everything he does, and if he does anything newsworthy, then it's the task of the reporters in the press pool, AKA the White House correspondents. A press pool to report that back to the other networks and in print media. So you're tethered to, in my case, since I was a broadcast journalist for TV, you're tethered to a microphone sometimes for hours upon hours. I can remember one time in Key West, Florida, when President Bush went bone fishing, I was tethered to a microphone for 9 hours straight, and of course nothing happens. More often than not, nothing happens. You're just, you know, we used to call it the death watch, basically. That's what we were doing.
You were there in case somebody tried to or did kill the president so that you could then report it, because most of the travels and things going on were not terribly interesting to the public. We're going to pick up the conversation when we come back after this with Norman Robinson. I'm curious your thoughts, folks. If you want to join the conversation, call me and text me now on the Oakland Art Jewelers Talk and Text Line at 504-260-1870. Should the president of the United States handpick which networks, which news organizations, which journalists cover the White House and cover the administration and cover the president? Or should it be done like it's done been done for many decades, with a correspondents association, a third party, picking who is in that number? We'll continue the conversation after this on WWL as we get you updated on traffic. Someone texts us and says, "You're putting out fake news. What a shame." Even Fox News's White House correspondent has publicly condemned the White House for what she says is them trying to handpick news outlets that will be allowed to participate in the presidential press pool. So when Fox News is condemning Trump, you might want to think twice and reconsider that statement. Norman Robinson, a former White House correspondent, is with us. Norman, how do you see this all ending? Where do you see this going?
I think it's going to end at the Supreme Court, because this is what Thomas Jefferson had to say about freedom of the press, and that is, you know, that it cannot be limited without being lost. And you know, he had a strong belief that free press is essential to maintaining liberty and should not be restricted in any way. And that goes for a president who tries to handpick the people who's going to cover him. This is simply a president who wants to punish people who print and write and broadcast information that he disagrees with. You know, that is just totally anathema to a democracy. This is a man who wants to shape and form the country in his own image and do whatever the hell he wants to do. And he coined the phrase fake news to protect himself from the thousands of untruths that he tells every time he opens his mouth.
Thank you, Norman. We're running out of time, but I appreciate your joining us and your service to the journalistic community. Yesterday, the White House barred AP, Reuters, and other media from the cabinet meeting after previously saying they want to handpick who covers them. Is this dangerous, or do you support him even if you're a Trump voter? Tommy's out. I'm in. Glad to be with you. Earlier, Mike Strain, the ag commissioner, told us he loves sweet potatoes in his crawfish boil, and it's become the topic of discussion. One person says, "I've been doing sweet potatoes for years now," they text us. "They are my absolute favorite extra in the boil." Somebody else says, "Sweet potato in crawfish boil is great. Carrots also." Several people text us, "Pineapple." That's along the same lines, the sweet and the spicy. Somebody else is taking issue with Joe Cardosi's yucking it. Says the man is willing to pull a crawfish in half, eat the tail, and suck the juice out of its head. But sweet potato in the boiling water is gross? Curious. We'll continue the conversation on the Oakland Art Jewelers Talk and Text Line at 504-260-1870. But right now we have to shift topics. Heart disease has been the leading cause of death in the United States since 1950. And February is American Heart Month. Dr. Brent Wallace joins us now from People's Health to talk about heart disease and ways to lower your risk. Plus, he shares how heart attacks can look different in women. Morning, Dr. B.
Hey, Dave. How you doing?
I'm doing. You ever had a sweet potato in the crawfish boil?
I had some last weekend for the first time, and they were fantastic, actually.
Did you expect it to be fantastic?
I did not. I like the pineapple. That's one of my favorites.
All right. Yeah, I'm going to have to try the sweet potato. Now, I've never done that. We've done all kinds of crazy things in there. I've even done an entire turkey in crawfish boil for Thanksgiving one year, and it was a big hit. But I have not done sweet potato, so I'll have to try that. On the topic of heart disease, let's start with the basics. Tell us about the human heart.
Yeah, so the heart is really kind of the center of your circulatory system, and it's a, you know, it's a very strong muscle that actually moves all the blood through your body. It's going to carry all those oxygen and nutrients to every organ that you have. So it really is delivering all the fuel that you need to keep your body's system running in a very healthy way.
Yeah, no doubt. Obviously, the central part of our ability to, you know, the brain and the heart, without those two, we got nothing, right?
So exactly.
And for generations now, heart disease has been the leading cause of death. What is heart disease?
Yeah, so heart disease is kind of a general or an umbrella term that, really describes a whole range of health conditions that can affect the heart itself, but they can also affect the arteries and your blood vessels. And when we talk about heart disease, the one most people think about is what is really called coronary artery disease. And the coronary arteries are the blood vessels that actually bring the blood to your heart muscle, so it fuels that muscle itself. And what can happen is plaque can build up on those coronary arteries. That causes them to narrow or even become blocked. And that's the process that makes it hard for that oxygen-rich blood to get through to the heart and enable it to keep pumping.
So that's where we hear about bypasses and stents and those kinds of things to keep that blood flowing to the heart. Also, we hear the term arrhythmia often. How does that factor into heart disease?
Yeah, so an arrhythmia, which is very common as well, is actually just an abnormal heartbeat. So it's an abnormal rhythm of the heart. And it could be that the heart is beating too fast, it could be beating too slow, or sometimes it may beat in an inconsistent way, maybe extra beats or some dropped beats. And a lot of arrhythmias are completely harmless, but there are some that can be very life-threatening. Another big problem that we see a lot is heart failure. And heart failure is really serious. That happens when the heart can't actually pump enough blood to support the body's needs. And it may be because the heart is either too weak or maybe too stiff. So it really has trouble getting the blood to where it needs to go to fuel all those vital organs like your liver, your kidneys, and especially your brain.
So what symptoms should we look for to know if we are having issues with any of these types of heart disease?
Yeah, I mean, everybody knows kind of a lot of the early warning signs. One of the most critical is either pain or pressure that you may feel in the center of your chest. You may feel a little fluttery feeling, like butterflies in your chest as well. That may be a sign of an arrhythmia. Some people may experience just really extreme tiredness or fatigue, and in particular, shortness of breath, maybe with some very minor activity, just walking up a few steps or maybe just walking across the yard. And then some people will develop swelling in their legs and feet, and that's a sign of the heart not being able to pump very well. So it's important to know what these symptoms are, but the one really important thing to keep in mind is the symptoms are going to vary by the type of heart disease you have. And sometimes an actual heart attack may be the first sign that anything is going wrong, and that's very true in women in particular.
And the symptoms for women can be different. So let's talk about that. Why is it so important that we address heart disease in women, which seems to be less emphasized historically throughout healthcare?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, heart disease is the leading cause of death for women in the United States. A lot of people don't realize that, but nearly half of women that are living in the States have some form of heart disease. Most have at least one risk factor for heart disease. And the American Heart Association actually estimates that less than half of those women even know that heart disease is their greatest health threat. They're actually thinking about other disease states.
Well, we see so much attention paid to breast cancer, for example, and so much fundraising associated with that and events and things like that. But we don't hear nearly as much about heart disease. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, I mean, you know, in the past, heart disease was more kind of considered a man's disease, whatever that means. But, you know, researchers actually didn't even begin studying how heart disease affects women in particular until around the mid-1980s. And these kind of sex-specific symptoms that people can have and the differences that they have from men, those risk factors really aren't widely discussed for some reason. So, you know, an example would be the most common heart attack symptom for men and women is going to be that pressure or pain, kind of discomfort in the center of your chest. But for women, chest pain isn't always the most intense or even noticeable symptoms, and sometimes it's not even present at all.
All right, well, I'm going to pause you there. When we come back, we'll talk about what symptoms women more commonly have that may be different than those that men have that we've heard about over the years, so they know if they have to take action to prevent heart disease, which you pointed out was the leading cause of death for all Americans, but even in women, and it somehow seems underemphasized. We'll continue the conversation with Dr. B after we check on WWL traffic. Heart disease kills over 700,000 Americans every year. That's about 20% of all deaths. Dr. B, Dr. Brent Wallace from People's Health is with us, and we were talking about how the symptoms are different in women. What should women look for to know if they're having issues that could be heart disease?
Yeah, we don't entirely understand the mechanism, but women are a lot more likely to have symptoms that may seem totally unrelated to the heart at all. And it may be something simple like a little extra tiredness or fatigue. In particular, women may develop what they think is indigestion or nausea, so stomach-type symptoms. And then it's not uncommon for women to not have any chest pain at all, but they may have pain in the center of their back or sometimes even in their neck or jaw area. And it's a lot more common, too, for women to have heart attacks when they're resting or maybe asleep. So those we call silent heart attacks, and they have no obvious symptoms at all. And we may actually find them when you come to see the doctor on something like a simple EKG. It may be weeks or even months after something happened.
So you just be sleeping, just relaxing, you have no heart pain at all, and you have a heart attack as a woman. It is baffling and something the medical community is still trying to figure out. Bottom line, though, what can we do since you don't have the symptoms the same in women and even in men? What can we all do to prevent heart disease?
Yeah, really, because of that, prevention is huge. And the American Heart Association really estimates that about 80% of heart disease can be prevented with something simple, just healthy lifestyle choices. And that includes things that everybody knows. You need to stop smoking, live completely smoke-free. That's one of the biggest risk factors. And then when you drink alcohol...
Does that include vaping?
The studies are still being done on vaping, and so they haven't made a definite tie yet, but I would not be surprised if they do link it as well.
All right, and beyond that, what can we do?
Yeah, drinking alcohol in moderation. So, you know, binge drinking in particular can be very dangerous for your health in general, but it's very bad for your heart. And then making sure that you're really practicing healthy forms of stress relief. You want to make sure that you're doing deep breathing exercises and not being super stressed all the time, because that increased stress increases your risk as well.
And of course, we always know we should exercise more and eat better, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, exercise, we always say 30 minutes most days of the week if you can. But, you know, don't be upset if you can't make it all the way through 30 minutes. You want to start slow and build up, you know, as much as you can. Even 5 minutes a day has a really healthy benefit on the heart as well. And then as far as the diet, which is really critical, you want to make sure you've got plenty of whole grains, lean proteins, and those fruits and vegetables. And everybody knows this too. Limit those foods in high salt, sugars, you know, trans and saturated fats, all the things we love, especially this time of year.
Everything that we're cramming down our gullets right now, yeah.
Yeah, so moderation. Moderation is really key.
Any final thoughts, Dr. B?
Yeah. Talk to your doctor about what your risk factors are. You know, they're definitely going to tell you to quit smoking if you're smoking right now, but they will also check your blood pressure, check your cholesterol levels. They can provide a lot of medications that can help prevention, but they're going to talk you through these healthy lifestyle choices. That's really what's going to make a difference in lowering your risk for heart disease.
Doc, thanks for joining us. Enjoy the rest of your carnival season. And you have convinced me now, and many others, joining in the chorus of people who love their sweet potatoes and their crawfish boil. So I'm going to have to add that to the menu.
I know. Enjoy it. Have a great Mardi Gras.
All right. You too. Talk to you soon. Dr. Brent Wallace from People's Health. We're back after the news. So there's this growing industry of devices, methods, and products to monitor worker activity to determine if people who work for you are actually working. And I think it's crazy. One person texts me, says, Dave, if you get paid an hourly wage, you should have to account for your hours. That is the difference between being an hourly and a salaried worker. Somebody else says it's not fair to the people who have to be at work that other people can work from home and they don't have to actually work all the time. Call it jealousy or whatever, but it's not right. Somebody else says, provide workers with a goal and a timeline. Turn them loose. Make sure they have what they need and wait for the results. Somebody else says, couldn't the same be said for office working? If my hours are 8 to 5, but I finish my work by 3, should I get to leave but still get paid till 5? I think so, yes. I have managed probably over 100 people in my career now. And I have always taken the approach, whether they were salaried or hourly, that as long as they get the work done. Now, radio is a little different. You know, someone jokingly texted, hey, I'll have that 5 a.m. traffic report to you by noon. No, obviously that doesn't work in radio. But the off-the-air stuff that people do and the other staff that don't work directly on the air, I have always been of the thought that, hey, if you want to get your work done late at night, if you want to get your work done before the sun comes up, if you want to take a long lunch or go to an appointment or go do something with the kids at school, as long as the work gets done, I don't care. Yes, I'll pay you to work till 5, but if you get it done and done well by 3, I don't have a problem paying you for those 2 extra hours, even if you're not actually at work. Somebody else texts us and says, my wife splits her week at home in the office. All she does is pack up the same laptop she uses at home and takes it to the office. She gets her work done whether she is in the office or not. And I get the argument that the movement towards everyone wanting to work remotely, everyone wanting to work from home, diminishes the team mentality in some workplaces, that you lose some of the togetherness and you lose some of the ability to have conversations and, brainstorming sessions and things like that. But again, that's all part of the productivity. If you feel like someone's not productive because they're isolating themselves from the rest of the team and they're not as much of a resource for you, or they're not as valuable to the team, well, then make a change. But if they are, I mean, this whole idea that we have to put in body heat sensors, motion sensors, and all of these other new things to determine if someone's actually working or not, judge them on their results. Wouldn't that make more sense? Let's check WWL traffic. Joe, you have to do the report now. You can't wait till later. So there's this growing industry of employee tracking tech so you can keep track of workers who are working remotely or in the office to make sure they're actually working when they're on the clock. And I just think it's crazy. I think it's a sign of poor management that they're not making. If workers are not working, you should know immediately without having to see if their mouse is moving, see if they're what time they're getting to work and leaving work, all these other things. You should be able to judge them based on, are the results there? I'm not saying that everyone should be able to work from home and should never be monitored or checked in on. What I am saying is that when you have to start using heat monitors, motion sensors, mouse monitors, other online tools to figure out if your employees are doing their job, then you as a boss are not doing your job to make sure that they are productive. One person texts and says, I work from home. It was great and productive for me. However, collaboration was very limited and new ideas slowly disappeared as communication directly with coworkers became limited. Well, then it's on your boss at that point to say, we need to find a way to get more communication amongst coworkers, whether that's coming back to the office, having regular meetings, doing some kind of online chats or whatever to make sure that you don't lose that inter-worker communication and that ideas aren't limited, because they say it eventually hurt the speed of innovation and sales. I'm just saying spying on your workers is a sign of a bad boss. That was really my only point, and it took on a whole new life. Hey, when we come back, we're going to talk to WWL Saints sideline reporter Jeff Nowak. Okay, for the blackout. Thank you. Thank you, Ian. Thank you, Joe. We'll talk to you coming up here on WWL. Right now, we invite in and welcome Jeff Nowak, the WWL Saints sideline reporter and digital content producer for WWL.com on all things sports and focus on the Saints. How you doing?
I'm doing good. I'm like right in the middle of like 2-2 from a parade perspective. So I'm feeling, I went to Allah last night. You know, tonight is Muses, and then I take a day off, and then I got Endymion on Saturday. And, you know, it's I live in Mid-City, so it's a big one for us, right? You know, we
are you on the route for Endymion?
I'm about two blocks off Canal, yeah. So,
you could charge for parking really at your place. Yeah, that'd be good.
Yeah. We charge for bathroom access is really the one people need.
How much does it cost to use your bathroom?
It's on a rolling basis of how much I like that person.
Oh, okay. Well, I won't be coming by because I don't want to know what you're going to charge me to use your bathroom. But I do want to know what you think is going on with the Saints. Quarterback getting a lot of obvious attention and for obvious reasons. Folks asking what's going on with the quarterback position, but it sounds like we're just getting coach speak and GM speak about Derek Carr at this point, and we really don't know what the future looks like at quarterback for the Saints.
Yeah, so we're obviously not. I'm not out in Indianapolis, so I wasn't there for the access that some reporters had to Mickey Loomis and Kellen Moore yesterday. I'm going off the same kind of reporting that everyone else is. I have talked to some people about it, but yeah, I mean, what I will say is when we talked to Kellen Moore in his introductory press conference, he was asked directly about Derek Carr, whether he would be the week one starter. And he very much kind of played it down the middle. It was not committal in either way. He was very complimentary of the player. But, he had multiple opportunities to say, hey, Derek's going to be our starter, and we're going to go with that. He didn't do it. Yesterday when he spoke to the media, he struck a different tone. Mickey Loomis struck a different tone. It sounded very much like Derek Carr would be back. And that always sounded to me like the most sensible option, just being, hey, you don't have a better option on the roster. And any objective metric you look at, it's easy to tell, like, hey, we won games when Derek was on the field. You went 5-5. It wasn't perfect, but you also went 0-7 when he was off the field, right? The options that you would have to bring back are not better, and there's really no immediate cap relief from moving on. So it sounds like there's going to be another season of Derek Carr as the starting quarterback. That could change. Maybe something weird happens in the draft. Someone falls to you that you weren't expecting, or a trade appears that you feel like is a great opportunity, and you go get somebody, and that changes your perspective. But Derek's $10 million roster bonus is going to come due in March, and if he's not off, if you haven't made a decision on him by then, it sounds very strongly like he's going to stick around because you can't trade him unless he okays it because he has a full no trade clause. So. It sounds like this is going to be, Kellen Moore was always going to be the biggest factor in terms of if he felt like he could work with Derek Carr and Derek Carr could do the things that he needs at quarterback position to do, then everything else would point to it makes the most sense to keep Derek, and I think that's where we're headed.
Well, I would have been shocked if Kellen Moore came in and said, yes, Derek Carr is going to be our starter, because he hasn't had the time yet to evaluate all the talent. We haven't had a draft. We haven't had free agency. There haven't been trade opportunities. And so it would be foolish, it seems to me, for him to say who the starting quarterback was going to be, either at his introductory press conference or even now at the NFL Combine, because so much can happen. Plus, you got the guy, and his contract is hefty. He's an expensive player, but that doesn't mean you have to play him, even if you keep him on the roster, right?
Yeah, I don't think you keep Derek Carr around and have him as the backup. I think you're going to play him because even if you draft a guy, it's not going to be, the number one overall pick. They're not going to trade up to the number one overall pick. It's too expensive. So you would need a bridge guy either way, and Derek would be that bridge guy. I really think it was, hey, is Derek the guy or is he not the guy? And if he's the guy, you keep him around and you start him. If he's not the guy, you bite the bullet and you cut him and you move on and you figure everything else out on the back end. I think it's a best case scenario in terms of, okay, can you be competitive this season? Because he's your best option to be competitive this season. I don't know how competitive that's going to be, but when you are a first time head coach walking into a building, you don't want to sign on. You don't want to co-sign a scenario that's like, hey, our ceiling is 5 wins. Our ceiling is 7 wins. And when you don't have a quarterback that you trust, then that's what you're signing up for. And no coach wants to have their first season be, hey, we're picking at the number one in the draft. Sometimes that happens. Sometimes that happens naturally. But I think that's the disconnect between when people talk about the Saints and what the Saints actually do is no organization in the NFL is making decisions in the offseason saying, how can we lose as many games as possible, right? Every front office is trying to win as many games as possible. And fans might, you know, get annoyed with that because they're like, I want the number one overall pick. That's the only way to get better. No front office is going to operate that way. So that's the disconnect of, like, people are looking at it and saying, how can we get bad enough? And the team is looking at it and saying, how can we get better? How can we win the most games possible? But no, I mean, it wouldn't have made sense for him to come in, for Kellen to come in with declarations of who the quarterback was going to be. All that said, you have now have an offensive staff hired. You have a better vision of what your kind of system's going to be and how you're going to work with these players. You have a quarterback's coach who, you know, you can bounce things off of. You've been able to sit down and meet with Derek Carr. Those meetings sounds like they have gone well. And so here you are. And now it kind of turns to, okay, what else can you do on the roster? I think the defense is going to be a way bigger story for this season than the offense is going to be, because I feel like Kellen can walk into that room and get that offense headed in the right direction. One guy to keep an eye on is Cedric Wilson, who early in this process, the wide receiver they brought in last year, I would have told you he was going to be off the roster. You could cut him and save $2.4 million against the cap. Well, now I look at it and say, Cedric Wilson is a former Boise State Bronco, just like Kellen Moore, spent 4 years in Dallas with Kellen Moore, and I think would be a perfect option to come in and kind of bridge that gap from offense to offense. So those are the type of things that change as you bring in coaches, as you bring in assistants. They have links to certain players. And, you know, I've kind of complete 360, I guess not 360, 180, because he's on the other side, on Cedric Wilson in that regard.
You're not back where you started. You're on the other side. Yes, gotcha.
right. I'm not just spinning in circles.
Saints see Derek Carr as starting QB, a guy we can win with, Mickey Loomis says. That's the name of the article that Jeff has posted at WWL.com right now if you want to read more of his thoughts on this and hear some of the interviews and get more information on Derek Carr as the potential starting quarterback for your New Orleans Saints in the coming season. That having been said, they have neither Mickey Loomis nor Kellen Moore have come out and said that Derek Carr will be the starter, correct?
Yeah, not in so many words, but yeah, I mean, the tone you're striking is significantly different. And it's, you know, I would say that Mickey came out and was a little bit more definitive on the situation than Kellen was. I think that's just how Kellen's going to be. Something we're learning about kind of in real time, because I don't think, you know, obviously we've been exposed to Kellen Moore for a long time. If you followed college football, if you watch any Boise State games, you know, he's won the most games of any college quarterback. So everyone's known about Kellen Moore for a long time. He was a pro quarterback for a while. He's been an offensive coordinator for a while. But none of us have really kind of spoken to him or encountered him. And I think that's how he's going to be as a head coach. He's going to be that kind of play it down the middle all the time guy. He's not going to give a ton away. He's a short answer guy. So I think it has the potential to get a little bit frustrating as we go forward of you know, you just want an answer and you're kind of getting this halfway all the time. But I think from where we're at right now, I feel pretty confident Derek Carr is going to be back.
We're talking with Saints sideline reporter in WWL.com, Saints reporter Jeff Nowak. When we come back, we'll delve more into that discussion that he hinted at about the defense and what's Kellen Moore going to do as the new head coach of the Saints to improve on the defensive side of the ball and make this team competitive and actually hopefully be a playoff team. I'm Dave Cohen. If you have any questions or thoughts you want to share with Jeff Nowak, jump on the line at 504-260-1870 or text us on the Oakland Art Jewelers Talk and Text line at 504-260-1870. Back with Jeff Nowak after this. I'm Dave Cohen in for Tommy Tucker. 925 in for Tommy Tucker. Jeff Nowak is our guest, WWL Saints sideline reporter and WWL writer for WWL.com. Jeff, you talked about the defense maybe needing even more attention than the offense for the Saints. What do you see Kellen Moore doing as the new head coach of this team to address some of the defensive troubles they saw last year?
Yeah, so, you know, I think you're going to see this next season and the next few seasons one of the bigger scheme changes that we've seen this defense have in a long time. Obviously, since Dennis Allen was here, you've had that 4-3 big body defensive ends, press man corner. And I think it's going to be a lot different. They brought in Brandon Staley. Assuming that he's running anything similar to what he ran with the Rams, which you know, that was the best defense in the NFL in 2020, his lone season there. And then with the Chargers, didn't really work out as well. I don't think the personnel fit quite as well, and it takes a little time to transition, and I don't know if they ever got to what they needed. But that's going to be a change for the Saints, right? And you're out in Indianapolis right now, and you're going to be looking at a lot of players who could potentially come in and get significant time very quickly, because you're going to be bringing in guys that can do the things you need them to do. And you know, I think the hires they've made are indicative of that. In that, so if you look at the offensive side, it's all NFL assistants, guys from other NFL rosters, Doug Nussmeier, TJ Paginetti from the Eagles, you know, a few others from around the NFL, Joel Thomas, Brendan Nugent, former Saints coaches coming back. On the defensive side thus far, we've got three hires that we know of, and all three are longtime college assistants. One is Terry Joseph, who spent the last 4 years at Texas. He's a New Orleans native, actually played baseball in college, was drafted by the Cubs before transitioning to football coaching. You've also got Bo Davis, who they just hired today. He was the defensive line coach at LSU at last season, a very widely respected coach. You also have Peter Sermon, who was the defensive coordinator at Cal. He's coming in to coach linebackers. And to me, that's indicative of, hey, the only way we can get better on the defensive side of the ball is by developing young players. And who is better to come in and develop young players than guys who have developed young players in college over the last however many years? I think Terry Joseph is really interesting because, you know, we're going to talk about the combine. You look at the combine, one of the more intriguing kind of zone corner prospects coming out is the 2024 Thorpe winner, who's Jahdae Barron, who Terry Joseph helped develop at Texas over the last 4 years. So, you know, I think you're looking at this situation and you're saying, hey, how are things going to change? And it's tough to see the paths right now until you get the young players in the building, because you have 9 draft picks. You're going to make a lot of them. I would wager that a majority of the picks comes on the defensive side of the ball. And then from there, you just got to figure out what players on the roster can do what, you know, what do they need them to do in Brandon Staley's scheme.
The Saints have one of the oldest rosters in the NFL in terms of age of players. You know, you noted they have 9 picks. And Mickey Loomis said something interesting yesterday, that they like players who like to be coached. And you talk about the youthful movement, it seems like, through the hiring process and the coaching ranks. Do you anticipate we're going to see a lot more young players, rookies, newly acquired younger players added to this roster and seeing significant playing time?
Yeah, I mean, you'd imagine so. You know, Mickey did intimate yesterday that they were going to be aggressive in free agency and see, and maybe be more aggressive than they were last year. I do think it's interesting because one of the reasons they are viewed as this old roster overall is like the average age. But one of the reasons the average age is so high is because, you know, there's not many defenses in the NFL who are relying on 35 plus year old players. The Saints are relying on 2 of them in Cam Jordan and DeMario Davis. Cam Jordan, you can point to and say there's been a significant drop off. DeMario seems like, you know, he's still playing at a very high level. So it's weird because I feel like they did have a lot of young players on the field for a majority of last season. I mean, you look at that.
Yeah, thanks to injuries. Yeah,
thanks to injuries, exactly. But I mean, most of the season you were starting a rookie across from a 30-year player in Alante Taylor and Kool-Aid McKinstry. Jordan Howard was getting a ton of time. At the linebacker level, you were playing Anfernee Orji a lot. Pete Warner's still a young player. So, you know, it's tough because I think the issue is not so much that they don't have young players. It's that they don't have young players that are pushing the older players off the field, right? And so I think that is a big part of it, is you need to hit in the draft. It's not just bringing in young players and throwing names and faces at the problem and hoping that fixes it. It's finding the right young players. And when you look at the last 4 or 5 drafts, they just haven't done that. Yeah, I mean, there's been so many picks that just have not hit.
Yeah, and you point to someone like, though, DeMario Davis. What'd you say? He's 35 years old? But he doesn't
36.
He doesn't play like a 36-year-old. So I don't know that just looking at the age of your roster really tells you anything. That's obviously one factor. But if you've got older guys, and I say older guys at 36, in NFL terms, older guys, at 36 on your roster who are still productive, then that's not a negative.
Right.
That's a positive.
Right. Well, yeah, you have the 36-year-old, and it's easy to look at the age and say, oh, this is a problem. But what if the 36-year-old is vastly outplaying the 25-year-old that you have that could take over for him, right? Like, that's the issue. At a certain point, there's value in getting a young player on the field to develop them, and that's where you have the Zach Bond paradox of, like, okay, this is an all-pro player. We know that now because he was all-pro this year, but they couldn't get him on the field because they were never willing to bite that bullet and say, hey, we want to get younger. We're going to move on from the veteran, even though they're still playing at a high level. Bobby Abreu says this all the time, and it's a cliche for a reason. You'd rather be 1 year too early on a player than 1 year too late. And I just don't think the Saints have been willing to be 1 year too early on some of these veteran players. And a lot of it goes to the cap. And when you talk about how they manage the salary cap and what's the actual penalty that gives you, because, you know, they can do what they want financially. It's complicated, but they can get it done. The issue that you run into is when you're talking about, hey, we want to move on from a 35-year-old player who's still capable of getting the job done. Well, to do that for the Saints, you would also have to accept, well, we're going to have this massive dead cap hit that we don't have to accept as long as we keep him on the roster. So you end up taking some of these players who you might move on from and keep them around for another year or two. With DeMario, it hasn't been the end of the world, but it did mean you missed out on a Zach Bond because you couldn't get him on the field. They tried to re-sign him. He wanted to go somewhere he would play. Another example, in my opinion, would be Mike Thomas. I think the Saints would have moved on from Mike Thomas a year earlier, but it just did not make financial sense. So you kept him around. You tried to make it work. It didn't. It went down in flames. And then that whole situation blew up and really kind of destroyed your locker room chemistry for that season. So, you know, I do think that when people complain about the salary cap, sometimes I think they look at it the wrong way and they say, like, hey, well, financially, they can't get it done. Financially, they're fine. It's holistically, when you look at the roster, like, why are they so old? Why are they relying on old players at all of these important positions? It's because it's cost prohibitive to move on from them.
And salary cap, obviously the Saints are in a precarious position when it comes to that, but we've seen that in the past where they find ways to do some restructuring, move some money around, and can still be aggressive in free agency and bring in some players. Mickey Loomis said they're going to be aggressive in free agency. Do you see huge acquisitions either through the draft or free agency or trades for this Saints team? Can they get some of these major talents around the league in New Orleans and turn things around quickly?
Yeah, I don't know if that'll be the smart approach. You know, there might be some options to go out and get some guys. You know, they can free up cap space pretty easily. If you look at it and we say $47 million over the cap, if you restructure Derek Carr's contract, which it sounds like you're going to do, that's $30 million of that right there. And then you can get to cap compliance plus about $2 million by only restructuring the obvious easy names, which is Carl Granderson, Cesar Ruiz, and Eric McCoy, which I don't think anyone's going to complain about saying, hey, we're committed to these guys for a few extra years. So from there, any move you make frees up additional cap space. So if you did want to bring in somebody, you could either, you know, ask somebody to take a pay cut. Maybe Taysom Hill is willing to take a pay cut. That frees up some extra space. There's a lot of options you have. If the Saints are being prudent, they will be kind of sticking to this, you know, 1 year deal cycle, maybe a 2 year deal if the numbers make sense. Like last year, you look at, they didn't sign it. I think Cedric Wilson was the only guy who signed a 2 year contract. You know, the year before that, you had a few, and, you know, Colin Saunders, Nathan Shepard, Jamal Williams all signed 3 year deals. Obviously, you also brought in Derek Carr in that big contract. But I do think there's going to be some level of, you just have to be practical about where you are as a team and understand that one big major free agent is not going to change things for you. It's not going to move the needle for you enough to get saddled with a contract that you're not going to want next year. So I think they're going to be willing to spend, but the contracts have to make sense. A guy like Marquez Valdes-Scantling, I think they'd like him back. I think he'd like to be back, but, you know, he's not going to budge on his contract. He's going to want the contract that he feels is merited. So what is that? And what do the Saints feel like they'd be willing to pay? That sort of thing. I don't think there's going to be any major moving, shaking contracts the Saints hand out. But I also don't think they're going to be sitting there saying, oh, we don't have any money, we can't sign anybody, because that's just not true.
You mentioned Taysom Hill. You think he's back in the black and gold? And is he a contributor to this team going forward after the injuries he suffered the last several seasons? We know what he can do when he's healthy, but Is he part of the plan moving forward?
Yeah, Kellen did speak pretty glowingly of Taysom when he talked about him in his introductory press conference. He basically said, like, hey, everyone in the NFL has been looking for Taysom Hills. They've been chasing Taysom Hills over the last several years. The problem is there's only one Taysom Hill, and he plays for the Saints. And so, you know, that sounds like a guy who's eager to work with Taysom. You know, the issue with Taysom is, you know, you can't just cut him. If you cut him, you're not really saving anything. You could make him a post-June release. You get two of those, and then you can split that cap hit over two seasons. So theoretically, if you did that, you could clear $10 million for this season, but then you would be $10 million dead next year. So I don't know if they really want that $10 million to go do something with, maybe. But I don't know. I think he brings a kind of utility to this roster that, you know, you would definitely lose if he's not here. I don't know if you'd be able to replace it. I don't know what his role would be in a Kellen Moore offense. I think that's the bigger question, and whether Kellen wants to do that. But I do think Taysom's going to be back wanting to play. He had a pretty significant knee injury. So part of it, I think, is going to be, hey, you're going to go through that rehab process. You're going to get him back on the field, and you're going to be like, okay, what can this guy do? Is that knee really going to be a problem? And if he's not able to contribute at the level that you need him to, then I think that changes the dynamic significantly. I don't think he's going to be a trade candidate. I think it's really going to be that. Is he healthy? Can he get through the offseason program? And from there, do you have a role for him? Because if you're not willing to get him on the field and use him, then he doesn't make sense on the roster, if that makes sense. Like,
yeah, no,
he's not going to be a guy that you keep around just to have two or three snaps a game. He's got to be used at the amount he's getting paid. If he's not, then I think he is gone.
Well, and statistically, we saw when he was healthy and he got more than a dozen snaps a game, the Saints' likelihood of winning dramatically increased. And the statistics were very clear, but sometimes he was underutilized and sometimes he was hurt. So we will have to wait and see. All of this being said, and thank you, by the way, for taking a look at the offense, the defense, the salary cap issues, free agency, the draft, and everything else. We're still early in this book. The Saints are only at the combine right now, so we don't know a whole lot of what the future holds through all of these mechanisms. But bottom line, are you feeling that the moves are being made at this point and that the writing is on the wall, that this Saints team has the potential to be significantly better next season?
I think anytime you bring in a new head coach and you get kind of that enthusiasm boosted, you can have a bounce back season. I'm not going to go out and say they're going to be in the playoffs, but I do think they're going to be more fun to watch. And that's the first step to becoming a better football team, is being a fun football team that you watch expecting that team to win and not going in kind of – Mickey Loomis says that they need to be a team that expects to win, not a team that hopes to win. And I think that's what you need to change if you're Kellen Moore. And I think he has the potential to do that for them.
Jeff, I look forward to reading more of what you have to write at WWL.com and hearing you here on WWL. Thanks for joining us here this morning.
For sure, Dave. Have a good one.
Great Mardi Gras. And, figure out what you'll charge me to use your bathroom during Endymion. He's Jeff Nowak. I'm Dave Cohen. We'll come back and talk about what happens to all the horses that you're going to see in Mardi Gras parades for the next several days, or have seen in the last few parades, because many of those horses are brought in just for the parades. Then what happens to them? Well, you can adopt them. We'll find out more about that coming up after this on WWL. 9:46, Dave Cohen in for Tommy Tucker. Hope you're having a great Friday Eve. You see all those horses in all the Mardi Gras parades? Well, most of them are there just for those parades. They don't belong to the people riding them, so they need a home after Mardi Gras. Rena Sweeney is with the Louisiana Humane Society. Happy Mardi Gras, Rena.
Happy Mardi Gras.
Glad you could join us. You're looking for homes for these horses after the parades are over, huh?
Yes, we are. We're doing great this year. Our program is going to rehome 20. And overall, we are probably going to reach about the 140 horse mark this year in the history of the program.
How does it work? If someone has a desire to get a horse and they have the suitable accommodations for that horse, what do they do to try and keep this horse what do they do to try to save this horse from a fate that would not be good?
Yeah, they can follow us on our Facebook page or our website, MardiGrasHorses.com, and one of two ways. Either they can put in an application that they'll take any horse and they can pick after they're approved, or sometimes people have a specific horse they want. So they would put in an application after looking at all the horses available. And once we've made sure that they have the means, you know, as far as where is the horse going to live, you have a vet and a farrier lined up and all of that, they're approved and they confirm which horse they're going to adopt. And then after Mardi Gras, they come pick it up and get to take it home.
140 horses over the life of the program that now have good homes, thanks to MardiGrasHorses.com and the Humane Society of Louisiana. And there's not a lot of time we hear the term rescued. You rescue these horses. Mm-hmm. That seems to indicate there'd be something wrong with them. Most of the horses I see in these parades, they look healthy, they look happy, they look well-behaved. Looks like a good horse that someone would want to have.
Yeah, typically the biggest issue that we see with these horses coming in, honestly, is that they're underweight a little bit. Not so much so that, you know, they can't be ridden or adopted and worked with, but, you know, they're a little skinny. And so typically once they're in a home and have been fed well for a little bit, they fatten right up and are happy. We just don't know anything about their background. They come from a broker, so they could have wound up there just because, you know, their owner passed away or couldn't care for them anymore for whatever reason, financial, or they moved and didn't have land anymore. We just really don't know. But yeah, a lot of these horses are really great animals and are able to be ridden or be pets. And, you know, some need a little bit of work, but typically with a trainer, that's something that they can handle.
MardiGrasHorses.com is the website if you want a horse and you can accommodate that horse. Now, it's not entirely free. You're not just going to give these people the horse. There are some costs associated with the program that they have to cover, right?
Yes. So the adoption fee really is just going back to compensate the stable for what they paid the broker to get the horse out of the system, essentially. We are not making money off this. The Humane Society of Louisiana is running this program just with volunteers, and, you know, any expenses incurred are covered from donations. So you're really just kind of helping to, again, cover the cost of getting that horse out of that system that it will never go back into. Once they are in our program, we're committed to them for the rest of their life.
About how much money are we talking?
The adoption fees typically range around $700 to $1,500, depending on the horse.
All right. And that's a lot less than it would cost to buy a horse through more traditional means, right?
Yeah, I mean, listen, also, I feel like if you're getting a whole horse, that's a great deal, isn't it? people pay that much for a dog.
Yeah, we talked around it a little bit, but this program was founded for a reason, and the Humane Society got involved for a reason, because there were questions and concerns about the future of the horses that we see in these Mardi Gras parades. What was happening to these horses?
So typically they are purchased from a broker. They would come in, be used for Mardi Gras, and then be sold back to the broker. And there is a market, unfortunately, for horse meat. And so their future being uncertain meant that they could have maybe gone to a home, or they could have gone for slaughter. And we found out that quite a few were having that happen, and we were just floored. We had no idea that when we're out on the parade route enjoying things, that these are not people's pets that they're riding. And so we felt like it was our responsibility to step in and make sure that these animals were going to be safe and go into a loving home after they serve our community in a way that's so important to the culture here.
Do they still use horses to make glue? Is that a real thing? Do they send horses to the glue factory, or is that just something that we hearken back to?
I actually don't know about that, but man, okay. I would hope that is not true.
because Elmer's glue seems so innocent. I would hope that's not the case. All right, Rena Sweeney, thank you so much for joining us from the Humane Society of Louisiana. Again, the website is MardiGrasHorses.com. Have a great rest of your Mardi Gras celebration, Rena.
Thank you. You too.
Thank you. I'm Dave Cohen in for Tommy Tucker. We're checking the text line at 504-260-1870. See what you've got to share on the Oakland Art Jeweler Talk and Text line up next. And we'll check in with Newell Norman. See what he's preparing for the next 3 hours here on WWL.